Hello, and welcome to Media Ministry at Holden Village. Today's date is July 30th, 2004. Today's session number is COD-2004-03. Today's speaker is Don Coberly. The lesson for today is Summon Out the Geologist in You. Basic geology, detective work without the blood, usually. Let's listen in.
My name's Don Coberly. I work as a hydrogeologist, which means I study groundwater. I came to Holden Village for the first time in 1997 to work on the investigation of the mine site. That investigation has gone on since 1997 and has moved from the investigation phase into the feasibility study phase, which is we figured out what the problem was, now we're figuring out what it is we can do to make it better. And that will continue into the future, and hopefully at some point in the future we will be doing something active up here to help make the mine site better. I've also been on volunteer teaching staff a couple of times and also taught some elder hostel sessions. This series of sessions, it's really hard for me to keep series and session separated sometimes. This series of sessions is called Summon Out the Geologist in You, which is sort of in keeping with the summer theme, summoning out what we shall be. And also because it's my contention that geology is a very common sense science, and you, anyone in this room can become a geologist if they want to. The basic geologic concepts are all relatively straightforward. I have the thesis for this series up here on this piece of paper. How many theses did Luther have? 14?
95.
All right, well, this is 195th as hard as being a Lutheran. How about that? The thesis, my perception of this is, at its essence, geology is an observational science. It is based on observations of rocks, landforms, and the relationship of rock units with one another. Once observations have been made, it is then possible to make interpretations or advance hypotheses about the geologic makeup and history of an area. As I was putting this poster up a few minutes ago, I was thinking about the geologic makeup of an area and how, if you might do geology someplace else or in what other guise you might do it, if you're a property owner and you learn a little geology, you may know that there are good parts of your property to build a well on and bad parts of a property, or good parts of your property to put your house on and other parts that might not be so good. And we can learn that from doing observation. Another one of my things that people have heard here enough that they're wanting to stick pencils in their ears is geology is an observational science. We go out and we look. We go out and we smell sometimes the rocks. We go out and we feel the rocks. It's not an experimental science like physics is or like chemistry is, and it's not a calculation science like math is. We go out and we observe the rocks. I've got one hand out left.
Here. Here.
Okay. And that's what we're going to go do tomorrow. There is a hike tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock, meet on the Ark. We will take the 10-mile falls trail, and we'll look at the rocks. And do just what we said we're going to do. We're going to make observations, we're going to advance hypotheses, and make interpretations. So that's tomorrow. What I want to do today is review what we did yesterday, what took an hour to do yesterday. I hope to do in about 15 or 20 minutes today. Advance that cause a little bit further, look at a few slides, and then take about 10 minutes to do some preparation work for the field trip tomorrow. What we were talking about yesterday and what we'll continue to talk about today are the laws of geology. The analogy that I've been using is that if geology is a new language, that rocks are the words that make up that new language, but the laws of geology are the rules of grammar that help us place those rocks in a certain order so that now we can make sense of them. So, and these are up here. There is a principle and four laws, and again, it's easier than Lutheranism, because there's less to it. The first thing is the principle of uniformitarianism. the distillation of that is the present is the key to the past. The physical processes that we see operating today are those that have worked in the past. The physical laws that we know about now, gravity, has continued to work over the 4.5 billion years that the Earth has been around. So, the first slide that I have, that is a piece of paper in your packet that we looked at yesterday, is on one side a series of fossil marks in some rock that is 3.5 billion years old. The companion to that is a picture from a mud pot somewhere in Bolivia. And so here we see something happening today that generates this pattern of concentric rings. Here we see precisely the same, or as far as we can tell, exactly the same thing in some rocks that are 3.5 billion years ago, old, excuse me. And we make the assumption, or advance the hypothesis, that this that we see today that creates these shapes, we can look back in the past and say, oh, well, 3.5 billion years ago, wherever we find this rock, there would have been hot pots there. To me, there's nothing at all astounding about that. And it's the founding principle of the science of geology. Other things that sort of flow out of that, if we see a glacier moving today, as we might see in Alaska or in the Alps, we can guess that even though glaciers have been have occurred on the planet, I don't know what the oldest known glaciation is, but it's 800 million or a billion years ago. We think that those glaciers flowing down valleys like this a billion years ago probably flowed kind of like the glacier did that cut Railroad Creek Valley, and then we can go look at something that's moving actively today in the Alps or in Alaska and say, okay, that's a glacier. It flows downhill today under the force of gravity. It always did that. It didn't used to flow up the valley because there used to be different physical laws on the planet. So what we see today can help us guess or make a reasonable hypothesis of what might have happened in the past. The last thing about that is, we look at Railroad Creek, we can go stand on the footbridge right now and we can see the creek flowing and we can see the size of the material that's in that creek. And we can kind of picture that in our mind and have it there for in the future. Where now if we go to whatever, the Front Range of Colorado or somewhere in the Appalachians and we see similar size rocks, my first guess would be, okay, I've seen rocks that size before in a creek. That's kind of a Railroad Creek-ish size thing. There's no reason to think that the physical laws over there are different than they are here, or that in the past it took bigger flows to move the same size rocks that we see moving today. So that's the principle of uniformitarianism. The second law that we talked about is the law of original horizontality. The distillation of that law is rocks get laid down flat. This applies predominantly applies to sedimentary rocks, which are what we find being deposited out in the ocean or at the mouth of Railroad Creek right now as Railroad Creek dumps out into Lake Chelan. And extrusive igneous rocks, the lava that comes up out of the Hawaiian volcanoes flows out. The law of original horizontality is things get laid down flat or essentially flat. The Hawaiian volcanoes have a slope to them of, I don't know, 3 or 5%, but that's close enough to flat for us. The point of that is not, I was about to say earth shaking, but that's not a good use of that. It's not there, I don't think that there's anything revelatory about that statement. The point is sort of what comes from that. So that if we see rocks that are stood up on end, they didn't get deposited that way. They got deposited and laid down flat, and now we have to invoke some second geologic event to get them stood up on end. If we find a series of rocks, a series of beds, when we walk across them on the surface, this is a geologist, and he's got a ball cap on. Is it reasonable to assume that these things got laid down by one grain or three grains of material falling into this layer and stacking up for tens and hundreds of thousands of feet. And right next door, we had grains that were a different color or a different composition, and they continue to stack up. That's not exceptionally likely to have happened. What's more likely to have happened is that those rocks got laid down flat and then tipped up on end. So, the law of original horizontality says things got laid down flat. The law of superposition. The law of superposition states that in these sedimentary sequences or with these extrusive igneous rocks, the oldest rocks are on the bottom. Again, nothing really weird about that. If you have the Rocky Mountains at time one, they start to erode, and so you have material that comes down and forms a fan, and that's of age one. At time two, the Rocky Mountains have worn down a little bit, and newer material has been deposited on top of older material. And at time three, same thing. Right? Mountains get shorter, wedge gets higher. So this is old, and this is young. Anything unique about that? Okay, really simple. Where we get a little hitch in our giddy up with that idea is what happens if once those rock units that have been laid down flat under the law of original horizontality, say, go into the area that we're talking about starts to be compressed. Well, at time one, that will compress, you know, we'll start to push on both sides, and at time two, maybe it'll be bowed up like this, and at time three, perhaps the whole thing will have done something like this. And so if we have a series of beds, here's old, and here's young, and here's old, and here's young, and so far so good. When we get right into this area, here's young, and here's old, and so now if we wear all this away and erode that away with the super eraser of erosion, and now our geologist happens to be standing right here, ball cap on, he looks down, and if we drill through those, we're going to go from older rocks back into younger rocks, right? So now our law of original, or our law of superposition has been blown up. So let's hold that thought for just a second. The schematic or the analogy that I used yesterday, and like so well, I'm going to use it again today, is here is a series of candles that I burned at the house and let the wax melt onto the plate, and I did it in a specific order, and there are no tricks here. So which candle did I burn, which is the oldest event, and which is the youngest event? Well, first guess is the youngest event is the red candle, because the red candle's still there. There's no tricks here, and use all the clues at your that are there. So the question then becomes, and we could check that. I mean, if somewhere we found this red wax and there was black stuff on top of it or yellow stuff on top of it, now you'd think I'm trying to sneak something in on it. But I don't see that anywhere. This red wax looks to be on top of the black here and looks to be on top of the yellow. It sure looks like it flows over the yellow right here. The two hypotheses are either that the yellow was there first and the red flowed over it, or the red was there and the yellow sort of snuck under it somehow. With this being a plate, that's hard to imagine. So red is the youngest. Is yellow or black older? And this little corner right here, this little part right here, seems to solve the problem for me. Here we see some yellow wax sitting right on top of this black wax. So in the candle problem, it's black is the oldest, yellow is the middle, and red is the youngest. If these were lava flows, and we could somehow identify them, through some chemical difference or through one's more vesicular, it's got more gas bubbles in it, it appears different to our eyes. We could trace these all around and we would know, depending on where we were, which was the oldest one and which was the youngest one, right? Where this scenario comes into play, we have a number, and it's in your packet, a number of different ways that these are criteria for determining the top and the bottom of beds. So if there was some characteristic for each of these beds that was somehow different down at the bottom, there was something, some identifiable layer. When we got back up around the corner here, and we saw that at the top, we said, well, geez, right down here, we were down at the bottom. We knew that. We believed this to be in place. Now we come here, and now it's the first thing we come across. That whole thing's been overturned. And there are a number of examples or a number of clues that are there. This comes out of a pocket sort of notebook size thing that you can throw in your backpack. That's just a collection of shortcuts and hints and tricks of the trade, so that when you're out doing geology and you come across one of these situations, you have these this toolkit, this bag of tricks that you can use to help you determine these things. We'll look at one of those because I've got a slide of it. And let's look at this example right here. This first example that they talk about is sort of the idea that I went through there, which is if you find the beds and you're convinced that they're in their regular orientation and now you can trace them around, now you know where everything is, right? Even the fact that one of them is now in the wrong sort of orientation, you've got it someplace where you believe it. Now you can say, well, let's trace it all the way along. It was on the bottom here, now it's on the top, it's been overturned. The question, or a statement I made yesterday or the day before is, well, okay, rocks get overturned. How often does that happen? That's, you know, if it's a freak occurrence, if it's there one place on the planet, who cares? Well, the closest place to go find overturned a rock unit is the Holden ore body, is in a rock unit that's been overturned. So you don't have to go very far. If you're out in the middle of Nebraska, it's probably not likely to happen. But in the west or in the mountains, or in the Alps, or in the Himalayas, there are places where just that thing has happened. A point that somebody brought up today as we were talking about this is, rather than this in my scheme here where this was overturned, he said, isn't it possible that this rock unit, rather than bending to such a degree, may just break right here and continue to be shoved on top of this? And that happens all the time as well. In Wyoming, there's an area that's called the thrust belt. And what you get is, rather than these folds, I don't know if I can do this with my arm without lifting it, the folds getting too overturned like that, instead this sheet will just break, and now you lay the two units on top of each other. And you see this repeatedly. There are places where there are two or three or four of these things stacked up on top of one another. You would know that. You'd have to be able to walk on that and see it. You'd also have to turn the whole thing sideways, which I suppose could happen. But particularly if you're drilling an oil well or a deep water well through that, and you're looking at the geologic layers as you're going through, you'll see this whole package in the first unit, or in the first of the first plate, the first thrust sheet. And then you'll keep collecting samples, and you'll lay out your samples every 50 feet, you collect a sample, and all of a sudden you get to right here at 2,000 feet below the ground, and you go, man, I've seen this stuff before. Well, yeah. And you look back, and here's the same set of units. You've gone through the same thing over and over again. So that can happen. The one example that I want to talk about right now that we'll show a picture of later is, you have some units that have been laid down, and then within that is a swale that has been filled in with some other material, and perhaps some of the material that's in the low spot looks like it's eroded material from those previous beds. That gets more sedimentation occurs, you find another one of these sedimentary beds, and there's another one of these divots. The note I have here is turn over and see if it makes more sense. The alternate hypothesis is, out in the world, we would see something like this, where you would have this little hummock with sedimentation on top of it, another hummock like this with more sedimentation on top of it. My belief is that when you get a little hill like that, what the world wants to do, what the erosive forces want to do, is erode that away. Somebody made the point yesterday that, well, what if this material is extra hard? You may find things like that. The other thing I would tend to see in a case like that is when this additional sedimentation happened on here, it wouldn't be completely flat. There would be little sort of wings that would come off that hill, right, as the sedimentation would occur. So I think this is a more likely scenario, and particularly if what you find in here is stuff like this, that's way more likely than somehow finding these little hillocks that contain parts of stuff that hasn't been deposited yet. That's a hard scenario. So that page in your packet and the next one just show a number of different methods of determining the top of beds. So if you determine that your section, layer upon layer upon layer, is what you believe to be what we call right side up, then you can be reasonably sure that the oldest material is on the bottom and the youngest is on top. We haven't talked anything yet about specific concrete ages. We're talking about relative ages, older and younger. That's the law of superposition. The next thing is the law of inclusions. This drawing takes a little bit of explanation. Let's think of a scenario where you have a rock mass in place, either sedimentary or igneous or metamorphic, and there's a fracture in that unit. And then you inject molten magma into that fracture. Between the heat of that and the speed with which, the force with which it gets injected, in some cases, it will shear off a piece of that host rock and incorporate it into the vein. We call that inclusion. It seems completely logical to me that the included material has to be older than the thing that it's included in, right? The other scenario is somehow this vein was here and these two rock units got put on top and bottom of it and somehow some piece of it got snaked into the vein. That's a lot harder sell for me than what I just talked about. And this is an actual example from my field camp logbook back in 1981 when I was a budding geologist. This is a really bad picture of a cut into a hill slope. That, like, if you would just take a bucket with a backhoe and dig a big trench on three sides that you could go walk down into. And my note is, dike of KG, which is this thing that there's a really bad picture of, cuts through the main body of KQM. K is an age designator. G and QM are rock type designators. It's not really relevant to what we're talking about. Let's skip past this for just a second. A xenolith, which is the technical term for this inclusion of the KQM, is present in the dike of the KG. So we had been at this location doing geologic mapping for 2 or 3 days and couldn't tell which the older rock unit was. And so in our logbooks, but I've got the original up here, I've always got a question mark next to which is the older, which is the younger. After we jumped down in this hole that had been dug and came back out, we knew precisely. We knew that the KG was the younger unit and the KQM was the older. The other thing to talk about here is a chill zone is present in the dike. Faster cooling leads to finer grain. At the fringes, at the edges of this dike, the grain size, the crystal size was smaller. Back on Tuesday, we talked about one of the concepts to get from looking at igneous rocks, which we'll do tomorrow on the hike, is the size of the crystal that you see is related to how fast or how slowly that rock cooled. right? If a rock cools slowly, there's more time for crystals to grow. So in this situation, that dike was injected into cold rock. Cold being world temperature, whatever it is today, whatever the temperature of rocks is today, let's call it 50 degrees. That stuff that was injected was at 1300 degrees. So you're injecting 1300 into 50. It's much cooler, where in the middle of the dike you've got 1300 right next to 1295, next to 1290, something like that. So what happens at the edges is those crystals, it's kind of flash freezing, essentially, and those crystals don't grow as big. The second thing that comes out of that, a baked zone occurs in the surrounding wall rock. Again, you're this cold rock minding your own business at 50 degrees, and all of a sudden this 1300 degree fluid, magma, gets injected in. What happens along those surfaces of the wall rock is they may recrystallize a little bit, or they may melt a little bit. And I forget what I say. A bake zone occurs in the surrounding wall rock. The recrystallization seems to make the parent rock darker. So there may have been some minor remelting and reformation of that stuff, and so it's darker at the near where the dike cuts through. So that's the law of inclusions. I also talked about bake zones and chilled margin. The last thing that I want to talk about in these rules and laws is the law of cross-cutting relationships. And yesterday I did a long involved explanation of this. I can make it much simpler today if I have a blank piece of paper. One of these. Now, I came across a few more copies of this packet. Does somebody need one? Have they gotten angry at their partner in the last 20 minutes? Okay. Here's a quick example of the law of cross-cutting relationships, and one you can use if you're ever out in the field doing geology and are a little bit, you've forgotten precisely what it is. I'm going to do two events here. One is I'm going to draw a line on this piece of paper with a green marker. We'll call that event one. That's the older event. The second thing I'm going to do is I'm going to tear this piece of paper. Tearing is the second event, and it's the younger event. Younger events cut older events. Right? Anything magic about that at all? Okay. So, when we take this from this example out into the real world, if we find a rock unit that has a fault cut across it, and it cuts the unit, the fault must be younger than the rock unit, right? The only other way to have that happen would be, here's this crack in space, and you fill in sort of above and below it, and that just doesn't seem to make very much sense. What we did yesterday, and what we'll go through really quickly right now, is a couple of these block diagrams to show this idea of the law of cross-cutting relationships. Here we have a series of three units that were laid down. We'll assume they're sedimentary units for the moment. Units 1, 2, and 3, we'll assume for the moment that they are right side up, so that through the law of superposition, 1 is old, 2 is intermediate, and 3 is young. And then we show a fault cutting across all three units. Therefore, the fault is the youngest event in this sequence. In block B, we show a fourth unit that has been deposited on top. The fault doesn't cross or doesn't cut the entirety of unit 4. Therefore, unit 4 is younger than the faulting. So here we have a geologic history talking about our thesis. When we see this in the field, what are we going to hypothesize? We're going to hypothesize unit 1 got laid down, unit 2 got laid down, unit 3 got laid down. The fault snapped, and then unit 4 got laid down, right? Again, nothing about this happened a million years ago and this happened yesterday or what. They're all relative ages. And what's in your packet is a series of increasingly more complicated scenarios And as I was thinking about this and looking through it, I came up with a problem. Let's look at this one for just a second. Here we have, again, what I'm going to guess are some sedimentary units, and we're going to believe that they're right side up, so that unit 1, 2, 3, and 4 all got laid down. After that, this dike intruded, because, and we know that it's younger than those things because it cuts all four of those units, right? We have this erosive surface right here. And what we see is some additional sedimentation, and included within that additional sedimentation are some fragments of this dike. This unit cuts the dike, ends it, terminates it, and as well you have some of this stuff incorporated in the sediment, is what I guess it is. And so, doing the geologic history, unit 1, 2, 3, 4 get laid down. Do we know how tall unit 4 is when it was originally laid down? We have no idea. It could be unit 4 could have been laid down up to higher than I can reach, and then over time eroded back down to this point, right? We can't say anything about that. There's another example there. Here's two more examples I want to run through, because this came up earlier today and raised a little bit of a point. What we see in this C example is units 1, 2, and 3 being laid down. Unit 4, I think they indicate in here as being an igneous unit. We assume, or we hypothesize, that unit 4 was laid down prior to unit 5, because we see these inclusions, in this case eroded pieces of unit 4 in unit 5, and then we see unit 6 on top. So in this case, this is the order 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 for the events. Anything funny about that? Another example, here's a couple of units that were laid down as sediment. Here's a unit that we think to be igneous, another sedimentary unit, and another sedimentary unit. And the point that it states in here, where is it? D, an igneous sill. Sill is a technical term for a bunch of magma that's been injected horizontally. An igneous sill, which has baked both the overlying and underlying beds, is younger than any bed of the sequence. Well, when I looked at that yesterday, while I was talking, I was looking at that going, I don't really think that to be right, but I'm not going to bring it up right now. So I posed the question earlier this morning, does anybody see a problem with what's been stated there? And my problem is, since these baked zones occur in unit 2 and 4, I can believe that unit 3 is younger than them, right? But I don't think you can say anything about unit 5. Unit 5 doesn't get cut by it. And so it's completely plausible to me that units 1, 2, and 4 got laid down, and then unit 3 got intruded to it, and then unit 5 got dumped on top, right? There's no reason why that can't be. Until somebody else pointed out that in looking at the paper handout that you have, what they saw is along these vein lines that there is some baking that goes on up into Unit 5, and if that's the case, then Unit 5 had to be there to get baked in the first place, right? This sill couldn't have come in and done its baking, and then Unit 5 got dumped on top, and then it got baked too. That doesn't make any sense. So this is one of those things where, if we were out in the field doing geology and I went out and looked at that and had the scale that I have, because I was working really fast and had a lot of ground to cover, and I blew past this and I saw this big zone, I saw this big zone and didn't see this little piece right here, I'd go, well, unit 5 is indeterminate, I can't tell. But since you're slower and more methodical and more thorough than I am, you came or had more time or whatever, you come along and you see that big zone or sticking up into unit 5 and you go, well, now I know the story, right? So, enough of that.
Well, if it's sedimentary, couldn't part of Unit 5 have been laid down after the bake zone? If it's
sure,
continuous.
Sure, absolutely. Yep, you're right. So, and that's I think a good point that comes out of that is for these sedimentary units, you don't lay down 600 feet of sedimentary unit in a day, right? You do it over some long period of time, and so this these naming of, you know, this is oversimplistic of what these rock units are or what they would be in reality. So that's a great point. All right, so that's the law of cross-cutting relationships. We've talked about relative age dating, which is what we've been doing here. 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 are older and younger, not 2 million, 5 million, 100 million years ago. And the next couple of pages that you have in your packet are additional examples of just the things we've been talking about so that you may hear them in a different way and they'll strike home for you more. And I want to move on to one last thing that I have written down on my list over there, which is the meaning of unconformity. Here's a picture that maybe a few of you have in color in your packet, and everybody has in black and white, kind of towards the back. You have this picture anyway, right? They're taken from the same place. This is Sicker Point in Berwickshire, Scotland. And this is sort of the birthplace of modern geology. James Hutton, who is regarded as the father of modern geology, was a well-to-do farmer, had too much time on his hands. I said something earlier this morning about this is one of those spaces not anywhere near Jubilee, so he had a lot. And he went down to the beach and he spent time sitting here and thinking about it. And this is in 1788, and at that time, the age of the Earth was 6,000 years, right? And there were two geologic events, creation and Noah's flood. End of story. Geology classes were really short in those days. Hutton saw this and had whatever the intellectual or the scientific equivalent of an epiphany is. Hutton knew, since he lived near the ocean and saw streams developing or delivering sediment to the ocean, and saw the layering, he saw each one of these layers, and he thought, just like we were talking about a minute ago, you don't dump 600 feet of sediment into the ocean at one time and call it a bed. And each of these beds that he sees indicated here takes a while to get laid down. So you have a couple of hundred really long times here, you have some more really long times here. Somehow this whole thing got pushed up to where we can see it, and he started to think that maybe there were greater forces at work. Can we develop a geologic history from what we see in front of us? I think we can, and I think we can see, I think I counted 6 events earlier this morning. We have nearly vertical units here. What does this say? Upper Old Red Sandstone, Late Devonian, which is an age, dipping gently, overlies vertical slaty mudstones and gray wacky sandstones of Silurian age. What I see here is, at some point in the past, these things were laid down. Because of the law of original horizontality, they were laid down flat. They're no longer flat. There's nothing we can tell from this photo to see whether these things were laid down flat and spun up this way, right? Or laid down flat and spun up this way. There's nothing available to us in the picture to help us. We don't know that. Once they were spun up, we had to have some erosive event, right, to cause this thing, which is what the unconformity is. The unconformity is a break in deposition. We had to have more sedimentation for each one of these layers. We probably had to have something to tip it up because it's a little more than 3 to 5 degrees, or since these are sedimentary, we assume they got laid down dead flat. And then we had something push the whole thing up to where we could see it and Hutton could stand on it, right? So we have sedimentation, 1. Tipping up, 2. Erosion, 3. Sedimentation, 4, a little more tipping, 5, and uplift, 6. So there's a six-step geologic history in one picture, and like I said, this was the birthplace of modern geology. This is not the only place this happens on the planet. This happens fairly regularly. I have a picture that I'll show you. And maybe now is a good time to get that computer rolled up.
Question.
Yes.
Sedimentation there was in its specific, distinct layers.
Yes.
And I picture sedimentation as sort of being maybe a continual change over time, but not, okay, today it's black and then tomorrow it's red. It would sort of flow from one color to the next.
Well, if that sedimenting thing was continuous, I mean, you know, so think of the Mississippi Delta, right? There are parts of that delta where there was sedimentation for a long time where there is no longer sedimentation simply because the river has changed course. Or some of those may have been flood deposits. I mean, when you get, again, next close to the river, you'll find these flood deposits that as they go farther away, this type of sediment is different, right? Or the size of it is different anyway. The highest energy stuff is next to the river as you go out farther. Seasonal things. You'll see this in lakes all the time, that there's a different composition of the sediment due to the season. So, I'm going to start this computer and we'll look at a few slides. Any other questions? Whoa. That's good for me. Is that okay with everybody? Okay. All right. Any other questions while we're talking, while we're waiting for this computer to go?
Well, on the sediments, so all this stuff here is after sedimentation, you've got processing, so it's tilted up and whatever, and the erosion. I mean, stuff is working on the sedimentary layers, right? Is that what's happening on this unconformable contact?
That unconformable contact, yes, exactly. There is erosion that goes on that surface, right?
And it's tilted up too, right?
Right. Yeah. And one of the, thanks for reminding me of that point, is most of the time in, or a fair, we have no way of knowing how much time is in that space, do we? If you go to the Grand Canyon and you have that whole big stack of rocks, there's an unconformity part way up, and that's the thing that represents most of the time. Because you had old sedimentation, and then a long break, and more recent sedimentation. So the fact is there's more time gone in the space than there is in the rocks that are there, which is kind of a hard concept at first. But that's what's happened. There's no way to know. We know it at Grand Canyon because we've dated the rocks, not relatively, but precisely, but given them a number. And the same thing at Sickert Point, right? I want to show just a couple of quick photos. Any other questions? I want to show you another picture of an unconformity. This picture is along I-70 in Colorado, near Glenwood Springs. This is I-70, this is one lane of I-70, here's the other lane, here's a railroad track. Here's a set of sediment, what I guess are sedimentary beds. Again, there's nothing we can see in the picture that helps tell us whether these things were laid down flat and turned up, say, 45 degrees, or whether they were laid down flat, turned up to 90, an additional 45 degrees to 135 degrees. If we were serious about doing geology here, we'd all get out of our cars and run across two lanes of traffic and the railroad tracks and go look. And we'd use our pocket guide. And we'd all clamber around on there, and sooner or later somebody'd yell Eureka, and we'd all go rushing over to where they are, and they'd show us one of these things, and then somebody someplace else would yell Eureka, and they'd either confirm the first diagnosis or change it. Then the unconformity, again an erosive surface, and again we have no way of knowing how much time is represented there. And then what looks to me like maybe mud flow stuff that came down, or river deposits that came down. The stuff right in here looks pretty rounded, right? I think you can see that from here, and fairly big stuff. It's not this might have been railroad creekish kind of size material. It's not some little puny stream that brought a bunch of silt down on top of it. That's pretty stout stuff. I should probably just show you this other picture, and then we'll move on to tomorrow. The title I have here is Unconformity or Not. And I'm unconvinced yet whether this is an unconformity where these units were laid down flat and spun up, and then there's an unconformity there, and then horizontal deposition above that, or whether these are potentially sand dunes that don't fall under our law of original horizontality. This might be the lee face of the sand dune. Sorry. And those were, they're essentially, you know, there's been no tilting of beds there. So again, I think this is the oil shale country. I think if we were there and in our cars, we'd all jump out and we'd go hunting around here to see if we could come up with some other evidence to help show whether that's actually an unconformity or whether it's a bunch of sand dunes. If we found, I'd have to think about what the clues might be, but now we'd be doing geology.
If it were a sand dune, wouldn't you have a rounded top before you had the trail on top?
Say that again?
If the lower levels were a sand dune, wouldn't you have more of a dome structure before the top levels came on top? Unless that part had been eroded off, in which case you'd still have an unconformity.
Right. And I think what you see in relic sand dunes, in sort of fossilized sand dunes, very often you'll see this pattern, which is just one sand dune on top of another on top of another. So I don't know. I have to think more about that. All right. Enough of that. If I could talk faster, we'd look more at these, but next time I'll do that. I'm going to turn this off. And what I want to talk about for the last 10 minutes is the idea of plate tectonics. Is there anybody who has never heard those words together before? Okay. This will power down in another second and we can... Excellent. Plate tectonics is the current most comprehensive theory of the science of geology. And we're always looking for comprehensive theories. The more things that a theory can explain, the better we like it. And what is the point of a theory? A theory is something that explains observed phenomena, right? It's nothing more than that. So the more phenomena that we can reasonably explain through one theory, the better we like it, so that we don't have 44 theories of geology. There are two main keys to the theory of plate tectonics. One being that the surface of the planet is covered by around 20-ish fairly rigid plates of material. And these plates are motivated around and across the surface of the planet by convection through the mantle. The planet, as we understand it, has three main pieces: the crust, which is what we're standing on right now, or what we'd be standing on the roadway anyway, the mantle, and then the core. The core is split into a solid, what we think is a solid central part. It's incredibly hot, but it's under so much pressure that the atoms are so close together that even though they're really highly heated up, they just can't move. We think that that's predominantly iron and nickel. The only way we think we know, or the reason we think we know that, is because of the way that earthquake waves travel through it and are refracted. So a solid iron-nickel core, a liquid iron-nickel outer core around that, a mantle, which is predominantly iron and nickel with a little bit of other stuff in it, and then the crust. of two types, either continental crust or oceanic crust. The center of the Earth is very hot. The outside of the Earth is reasonably cool, 50 degrees is what I'll call rock temperature at the surface. And so as the center of the Earth tries to dissipate this heat, we set up convection cells in the mantle, which is viscous. And so it can flow and transfer heat. As those convection cells come closer to the surface, they have some impact on these rigid plates, sort of like an eggshell sitting on a pot of boiling water. It'll spin around the top of the pot, right, or the pan, excuse me, kind of under the influence of these convection cells. When I give this talk, sometimes I will bring my old lava lamp with me because I think that's an excellent analogy, because you have a heat source down at the bottom. You have this stuff that rises up. It's colored so you can see it more easily. It gets to the top of the chamber, the lamp itself. It cools enough so that now it goes to sink and gets heated again. If I could find a lava lamp that was a plane, like a really skinny fish tank, so that I could actually generate those cells in it, now we got something. That would be a really good visual for people to see. So we have convection cells in the mantle. We have rigid plates covering the surface. What we find in the middle of the oceans, in many cases, which is one of the reasons why this theory took so long to take hold, was some of the key bits of information were pretty hard to get to. New material is being generated along these ridges all the time. It's being generated fairly slowly, but over geologic time you have new material being generated. So there are two alternatives. One is the planet's getting bigger, and the other is that somewhere else the remaining crust is being taken care of so that the size of the planet stays the same. There is a very small minority of people who think that the planet is in fact getting bigger. I saw, in my graduate career, an old guy named S.W. Carey came and talked at the Colorado School of Mines, and he is convinced that the Earth is both torsioning and getting larger. So that what those of us who believe in plate tectonics who have heard about it, at some point in the past there was a supercontinent called Pangaea that we placed at some point on the globe. His point was that was the size of the planet at the time, and since then the planet has been getting bigger, and the north and south poles are rotating opposite one another, so the planet is sort of opening up like this. Now, he's a true believer. Now, I don't know if he's still alive even, but there are not many people who agree with his ideas on things. But not to say that geology doesn't have room for new opinions, because back in 1910, when Alfred Wegener came up with the idea of continental drift, everybody laughed him out of the building. So it turns out 100 years later that he's right. So who knows, maybe SW carries on to something and it's just taken us a while to catch up to it. Anyway, new material gets created along these mid-ocean ridges. So what happens to the old material, or the how do we take care of additional material to keep the planet the same size? What happens, here is a diagram showing the current conditions along the coast of South America. Here's South America. This is continental crust. The South American continent is moving relatively westward. There is material that is oceanic crust. You have thicker, lighter density oceanic crust coming in contact with skinnier, denser oceanic crust. I call this continental crust, oceanic crust. Generally what happens is this oceanic crust is subducted, is pushed down under the continental crust. What happens as that material gets pushed down is it gets hotter as you go down further in the Earth. So this crustal material starts to melt, or portions of it start to melt. The stuff that has a lower melting temperature gets driven off, the water gets released, and both two things happen. One is some of that stuff makes it all the way to the surface, and you get these extrusive igneous rocks, volcanoes of the type of Mount Hood, Mount St. Helens, what's the one in Seattle? Mount Rainier. Or the Indonesian islands. And additionally, what happens is, in some places, you get intrusive igneous rocks that come up to somewhere near the surface, and this is more the Yosemite-style stuff. What happens as this plate gets subducted, gets pushed down, one of the things it does is it pushes up this front, you know, this is not a real smooth operation, because you're trying to get rid of 3 miles worth of material. So what happens is this plate is being subducted, one of the things it'll do is buckle up, and this is in compression, it's being pushed against something pretty hard, this thing might bow up a little bit. And that's, I think, what's shown here. And the material, as the mountains get raised higher, they get eroded back down. That continues as time goes on, so that in the future, we will see in South America these intrusive igneous rocks that may have cooled at 5 or 10 miles below the surface finally get exposed. The last thing to talk about this, one of the reasons we like plate tectonics so much is that it explains the distribution of earthquakes that we see. When you're closer to the coast, the earthquakes are fairly shallow. As you get farther inland, the earthquakes get deeper until you get to a certain point somewhere inland where the plate, we assume, is at about 700 kilometers, and you stop getting earthquakes. Why do you stop getting earthquakes? Well, because by that point the plate is so malleable. When you rub a rock against a rock, sometimes it breaks. When you rub a rubber ball against a rock, it doesn't break because the rubber ball just deforms, right? Oh, 3 minutes. It's going to work out great. Here's another picture. We have continental crust and we have oceanic crust. If you do a square diagram, what are the number of permutations that are there? Continental crust runs against continental crust. That's India hitting Asia in the solar plexus, continent against continent, now you get the Himalayan mountains. Continent and oceanic crust, we just talked about that. Oceanic and oceanic crust, we're going to talk about in just a second. How many other alternatives are there? That about covers it, right? Three. In some places, oceanic crust buckles and is subducted under other oceanic crust. This is the Australian plate and the Pacific plate. Here is a set of islands that are generated. Indonesia would be a perfect example here. An island arc is what it's called. Japan is also an island arc. The Aleutians are another island arc, right? You have these long strings with volcanoes running down the spine of them. The things that you get are the volcanic eruptions. Those volcanoes get raised, and now you get erosion and sedimentation coming off the flanks of the volcanoes. If we would take that and turn it around and flange it up with that figure, kind of right about like that. Can people still grasp what I'm talking about here? This is the situation, and right across out South America and make this North America and make this 800 million years ago, and this is the Idaho-Washington border. Everything west of the Idaho-Washington border is a series of these island arcs that have just been pounded onto the west coast of the United States, and the U.S. has gotten bigger as time has gone on. Of course, 800 million years ago, it wasn't the U.S. That happened sometime after that. So here we are 750 million years ago or something like that, and here's Holden Village right here. I know you think these buildings were built in 1938, but in fact, they're much older. So this is the Holden Village area at that, well, no, wait. This is the Holden Village area in this condition at about 75 million years ago. The stuff between 800 million years ago and 75 million years ago was the stuff to the east of us. And that was just another one of these sets of these, Japan got rammed on, and then Indonesia got rammed on, and then Alaska got, not precisely those things, but that kind of thing, and the continent has grown through time. So it's 75 million years ago, here we are at Holden Village, and between 75 million years ago and 50 million years ago, Holden Village got the piece of island arc that Holden Village was sitting on, got attached to the west coast of the United States, and since then, everything to the west of us has gotten jammed onto the continent. Okay? We'll talk about that tomorrow, and I'll show you at the end of the talk, or at the end of the hike, we'll talk about this in very sort of almost a cartoon picture sort of way. But that's the 3-minute version of the history of this area. Somebody's going to be in here in about 20 minutes giving another talk, so if you have any questions, I'm not blowing you off. Come and see me at dinner or after dinner, or ask me tomorrow morning on the arc before the hike. Hike's at 0800.
What time is the hike over?
I got to catch the 10:45 bus. I'm going to be back in the village at 10. So, and you can leave the hike any old time you want to. See you tomorrow.
Thank you.
Keep it if you want it, or leave it if you don't.